So the theme of the session, what's the theme of the session? 21st century Bodhisattva, 21st century Bodhisattva. So we're coming towards the end of the session. I haven't actually been here for any of the talks, so I've no idea what anybody's had to say. So I'm probably going to repeat a lot of what you've heard already. I just wrote the talk as it came to me. We'll just see what you've heard before and what you haven't. I'm with several of you not been here before. Hopefully it'll make sense. I won't be able to cover all the kind of ground we're likely to have covered, but I hope it makes some sort of sense to you. So the theme for tonight is dedication. 21st century Bodhisattva, and the theme is dedication. So imagine all of us at some time or other have seen one of those wildlife programmes on TV. I was up in Scotland at Christmas, and a friend there was telling me about a series he'd been watching by David Attenborough called Dynasties. And typically in these sort of programmes, you get like 45, 50 minutes documentary, and then you get 10 minutes or whatever of a film showing how the film was actually made. And it's then you get to see that all that amazing knowledge and all those pictures, what went into producing it. You know, you might have trapped an animal for 3 years or something like that just to get a few minutes of footage. And it's often done in difficult, quite even dangerous sometimes, conditions. Indeed, it's maybe that kind of wildness in contrast to everyday life. Maybe that's a large part of the appeal, I don't know. So to produce even something as everyday, it's part of our everyday lives, as a TV program, requires dedication. To achieve almost anything successfully requires dedication. It requires stretching ourselves, going beyond ourselves, and very often some kind of hardship or difficulty involved. And yet, because our heart is in it, if we're dedicated and our heart is in it, then it's also exhilarating. And if you have that experience, then life without it is going to be extremely dull. I can't imagine David Attenborough sort of giving up until he absolutely has to, because there is that kind of exhilaration of dedicating yourself, being dedicated to something in that kind of way. And when we truly dedicate ourselves to something, something else seems to take over. I'm sure we've all had this kind of experience. Like sports people often talk about being in the zone, don't they? If you're a professional tennis player, well, you have to surrender to the game. If you're a poet, you have to surrender to the muse. You have to get yourself out of the way. And if you're a teacher, if you really want to engage your class, well, you need some kind of inspiration, don't you? Something else needs to be added in to the equation. I have a friend who does Reiki healing, and she tells me it's the same principle applies there. You don't do the healing. It's not you that does the healing. The healing comes through you. You express the healing. The healing is expressed through you. It's not something that you do personally yourself. It's something you provide that's expressed through you. And the nature of the universe, or whatever we want to call it, we could say, is actually unconditional love. The nature of mind is unconditional love. We don't normally experience it that way. We don't normally experience things as unconditional love. It's not how we usually experience life, because we get ourselves in the way. So it's through self-surrender that unconditional love can begin to pour through us. When we bow to the Buddha, the enlightened mind, the enlightened heart, unconditional love can begin to pour through us. So I remember some years ago now, when I was living in Norwich, this is a long time ago, and there's a Lord member there called Arlika, and he was telling me about the early days of the movement before I came along, and the very first order weekends they used to have at Padmaloka, which is the retreat centre in Norfolk. And I think even when I first came along, there was like two tiny little dormitory rooms with maybe, I don't know, 8 or 10 beds in each, something like that. And so everyone used to just pile in higgledy-piggledy into the house or wherever they could, because there was nowhere really to sleep, nowhere sort of proper to sleep. And people used to just bring sleeping bags and sleep in the corridor. Arlika just used to bring a sleeping bag and just sleep in the corridor. And he's perfectly happy doing that. Didn't think in terms of like personal comfort, because they were dedicated. There was something else going on greater than their own kind of personal comfort and their own kind of personal concerns. So personal concerns weren't of any interest. They weren't of any concern at all. And it's thanks to that kind of dedication that we have the Tri Ratna movement as we have it today. And we have the Shrewsbury Centre as we have it today. And it's been the dedication of people involved in setting up the Shrewsbury Centre. We've got Jaya Ratna here and Saravantu. And a whole team of people who brought this centre alive, brought it into being through dedication. So we can dedicate our lives to so many different things. We can go beyond ourselves in so many ways. It's how we find our voice in the world. It's how we express our personal myth, if you like, our gestalt, as the psychologists say. We each have something unique to offer, at least potentially. And who we really are, we find out in the process of engaging with what most deeply moves us. So the question arises from a Buddhist point of view, well, what's the highest form of dedication we can undertake? What is the noblest ideal we can dedicate ourselves to? What's going to benefit ourselves and the world the most? And the answer from a Mahayana perspective is to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings, to alleviate the suffering of all beings. And this is what we call the Bodhisattva ideal. This is what the theme of these last few weeks have been about. So it's putting that at the centre of our lives, putting that at the centre of our mandala, as we say, at the centre of our pattern of existence, and placing everything else around it and in relation to it. So it's to commit ourselves, practice wholeheartedly. And that's the greatest good, says Buddhism, that can come from our lives. That's the highest ideal to which we can aspire. So if we get to read Shakespeare's Macbeth, or see a performance of Shakespeare's Macbeth, we get inside the mind of a serial, we get inside the mind of a serial killer. We can see how one killing inevitably leads to another in a dreadful downward spiral. And Shakespeare's genius is such that we can actually empathise with a serial killer. We realise, if only in a subconscious way, that could be us. and indeed is us in a small way. I'm sure we've all had issues to do with power, issues to do with power, getting our way at the expense of others. These are kind of issues that come up because we're human beings. It's part of the human life. It's part of what being a human being is. It relates particularly to the Titan realm in the Six Realms. I don't know if you've covered, for by now has been covering that. particularly relates to Titan realm. It's all about me in the Titan realm. Everybody's come from a basis where it's all about me and what I want, and what I'm going to get, and power. So it's part of the human predicament. And Macbeth works as a play because we can resonate with the central character. When Macbeth dies, we don't just kind of rub our hands with glee and say, well, good riddance, thank goodness for that. We experience the tragedy of what happened. We experience the pain and suffering involved of all concerned. And if we're at all open and receptive, we resolve to be kinder and more ethical in our dealings with the world. So unfortunately, Shakespeare didn't write anything about bodhisattvas. But we can get inside the mind of a bodhisattva. We can still resonate with what it is to be a bodhisattva. And we can do that in particular by engaging with the verses of Shantideva. And Shantideva was a bodhisattva who lived in the 8th century in India. So our world's a very different place than it was in 8th century India. I think even in England, I mean, that's kind of before King Alfred and the Viking invasion. It's before King Alfred and the Viking invasion. So life was very different at that time. And our busy, kind of nervous, aggressive, 24/7 kind of energy, our culture, is something that Shantideva would never have known. And we face global issues that Shantideva could never have dreamed of. So that's why we speak of a 21st century bodhisattva. But most fundamentally, a bodhisattva isn't rooted in time and place at all. He or she has at least one foot, as it were, in the transcendental. So we needn't be put off by the fact that these verses were spoken so long ago and in such a different culture. The general principles remain the same. The Buddha was concerned with universal truths, and they apply just as much today as they ever did. So Shantideva was a monk and a poet. He was also a scholar. And he lived in a large monastery or monastic university in a place called Nalanda in India with about 10,000 monks. I've rather lost track of how many order members we have these days. but I think that's probably about four times the number of order members we've got worldwide, all in one place in Nalanda in India. And there would have been visiting pilgrims, pilgrim monks, would have been visiting scholars from far away as China would come to Nalanda. And Shantideva's words have been a source of inspiration over the centuries in the Buddhist world, in the Mahayana Buddhist world. And it seems he wasn't the originator of the sevenfold format that we have, as in the sevenfold puja. He wasn't the originator of sevenfold puja, but it's his words that have become the kind of standard kind of format and tradition that we use. So his Bodhicharya Avatara, his verses, is the great poem of the Bodhisattva, just as Macbeth is the great poem or drama of the serial killer. So what does he have to say? What is the mind of a Bodhisattva like? So he says this: may I be a protector for the unprotected, a guide for wanderers, a boat, a bridge, a causeway for those who desire the other shore, a lamp for those who need a lamp, a bed for those who need a bed, a servant for those in need of service, for all embodied beings. So what's going on here? Well, as human beings, we generally find ourselves in an unsatisfactory world. However much joy we have, there are always difficulties. We live in the midst of uncertainties. We never really know what's going to happen next. And what we normally do in the face of that is to take refuge in our own egos, in our own narrow idea of ourselves, our narrow image of ourselves. We think that if we get what we want, then we'll be okay. If we can just jig things enough our way, for a little while, for a while, then we'll be happy. So our lives become a continual act of discrimination. You know, I want this, don't want that. Like him, don't like her. And so on. We can even bring this into our spiritual life. You know, want to do mindfulness of breathing. Damn, it's a metta-bhavana tonight. So if we take this to extreme, we kind of illuminate it. Taking it to extreme, it kind of illuminates what it is. And that's one of the great values I find in Shakespeare. So if we take it to extreme, well, we have the ambition of Macbeth. We have the jealousy of Othello. We have the pride of King Lear. We have the bitterness and sense of isolation and exile of Hamlet. These characters are all playing out like human dramas, the drama of what it is to be human, what it is to have an ego, if you like, what it is to have a narrow sense of ourselves. So Hamlet famously says there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. The state of Denmark being the state of samsara. And taken to extreme, well, we have the concentration camp. We have the Holocaust. We have the nuclear bomb. We have ethnic cleansing. We have species extinction. We have the refugee crisis and all the rest of it. That's the ego pushed to its logical conclusion. A narrow sense of selfhood pushed to its logical conclusion. And we seem to be living in darkening times. People keep saying this. I keep hearing this on the radio and various people saying this. We're living in times that are getting dark. But personally, I don't ever think we've had a golden age. It's never been a golden age when things were kind of wonderful. And the Buddha certainly didn't live in a golden age. He lived in a time of serious fragmentation. And Shanti Davis certainly didn't live in a golden age either. I mean, Nalanda, his monastery was razed to the ground by Muslim invaders, and reportedly the library was burning for 3 days afterwards, with all those priceless manuscripts going up in flames. So I don't think it's ever been a golden age. But we're certainly facing serious global problems, and problems that, as a you know, as human beings we haven't faced, we haven't had to face before. Well, we need to find another way of doing things more than ever. More than ever, we need to find another way of doing things, another way of relating to the world than what we are as a species, as a race, habitually doing at the moment. Psychologically, we risk being overwhelmed by it all. As a species, we risk extinction. So taking refuge in our egos, in our narrow sense of ourselves, is the problem, then what's the solution? Well, once again, it clearly lies in self-surrender. It lies in dedicating ourselves not to our own happiness, but to the happiness of all beings. That's the way out. That's the way out of samsara, both for us individually and collectively, to the extent that we can do this as a species, if you like, as a human race. So Shanti Deva says, "Nirvana is a giving up of all, and my heart yearns for nirvana. If I am to give up all, let it be to living beings. May I be a wishing gem, an inexhaustible vase, a magic spell, a great medicine, a wishing tree, a cow of plenty for all beings. As the elements of earth and water and fire and air are for the use of all beings who dwell in all of space in many ways, may I be the means of sustenance for the realm of beings in all of space in many ways, until all have passed into nirvana." So instead of being driven by the compulsive habits, wanting this, not wanting that, Shanti Davis surrendered himself to what we might call a superpersonal force. That sounds a bit intellectual, doesn't it? But he surrendered himself to something bigger than himself. Something else has taken over. If you like, a force that's greater than his ego. He surrendered something bigger than himself. And this is what we call the bodhicitta. I don't know if by now it's becoming bodhicitta. But that's like the kind of basis of the bodhisattva ideal. You got some questions in your in the tea break. I hope something of what the bodhicitta is. I hope, if you haven't heard that term before, something that the meaning of it will come across. So it's the bodhicitta, what's sometimes translated as the awakening mind, the heart that's set on enlightenment. And it's a force that's bigger than we think we are. It's what Sangharakshita refers to as a cosmic will to universal redemption, a cosmic will to universal redemption. So bodhi means awake, and chitta is the heart that knows. So bodhicitta is being awake to the heart that knows. So it's not what the ego knows. It's not what we know conceptually. It's what our heart knows. It's what our heart knows when we become awakened. That's the bodhicitta. So the question is, well, can we resonate with it? Can we resonate with that? Does it mean anything to us? Can we resonate with Shantideva's words? Is there something in us that longs to get away from our self-preoccupations and devote ourselves selflessly to the welfare of all beings? Is there something in us that rejoices at the prospect of participating in the forces of universal redemption, to use Sangharakshita's phrase? Can we find something in us that aspires to such dedication? If we resonate with the Macbeth in us, can we resonate with the Bodhisattva in us? Can we respond to our full potential as human beings? So I've said we needn't be put off by the fact that these words come from a long time ago, from a very different culture than our own. But we do have to be careful. Shanti Devi was addressing fellow monks in what was an extraordinary, vibrant and inspired environment. And in a culture that, by all accounts, was a lot healthier than our own in many respects. For one thing, we've had a couple of thousand years of Christian conditioning in the West. And even now, very few of us are really brought up to cherish ourselves. It's quite a rare thing for somebody, even now, to be brought up to actually cherish ourselves. It's generally kind of frowned on. You know, you're getting too big for your boots and all the rest of it. So we can easily misunderstand what Shanti Deva is saying. What he is expressing is unalloyed joy. If we're not careful, we might hear somebody who's denying himself in some way. Although being a bodhisattva is somehow good for us, or good for other people, but it somehow means forcing yourself to do something you don't really want to do. A bit like kind of eating up your greens when you're little. So the whole idea then of trying to help others just becomes an imposition on our time and our energy. Rather than being a spontaneous expression of joy and freedom, which is what Shanti Deva is getting at. It's a spontaneous expression of joy and freedom. So it has to be emphasized from the start that being a bodhisattva has nothing to do with being a martyr. It's nothing to do with guilt or feelings of worthlessness. It's nothing to do with self-denial. To be a bodhisattva is simply to be who we are in our deepest nature. It's an expression of wholeness. It's an expression of the most that we can be. What we can be at our best, what we can be at our most whole and complete is a bodhisattva. It's giving up our chronic habit of putting our narrow idea of ourselves at the centre of the universe. It's a bit like you spent a lifetime, like spending a lifetime doing serious drugs, say, and you've finally gone clean. Well, you just jump up and down for joy, don't you? That you've got freedom. You're free from the burden, the sheer burden of addiction. And you naturally want to help others who are still addicted. So that's what it's like for Shanti Devi. He's jumping up and down for joy, freeing himself from the burden of samsara, freeing himself from the burden of over-concern with his narrow sense of himself. He likens it to a banquet. He says it's a banquet of happiness laid out to refresh all that come. So it begins with self-metta. Our practice needs to be rooted in self-metta. The altruistic dimension of our practice arises out of metta. The whole process is one of making friends with ourselves at ever deeper levels, ever higher levels, until we are friends with our true nature, our deepest self, who we really are in our fullness, in our completeness. And if we're out of sorts with the world, well then we're out of sorts with ourselves. The two aren't separate. So first, our first task is to develop self-metta. That's where we begin. And Sangharakshita, the founder of Triratna, was very hot on this. He says on one occasion in it's a book called Wisdom Beyond Words, which I thoroughly recommend, he has this to say. He says, all that you can really be said to be here for is to develop some higher form of human life, to become a bodhisattva, to become a Buddha. So don't be ashamed of sitting around and doing nothing. Glory in it. Do things spontaneously, out of a state of inner satisfaction and achievement. It's a virtue to be ornamental as well as useful. I think, incidentally, that's one of the great aphorisms of all time. It's a virtue to be ornamental as well as useful. And he goes on, if you take this seriously, you have to be watchful for people trying to work on your feelings of guilt. How can you be spontaneous if you're riddled with guilt? So don't let people get at you with any kind of emotional blackmail. If someone starts saying to you, look how hard I'm working for the Dharma, don't you feel bad just sitting there doing nothing, letting me do it all? You should just say, no, I feel fine. I'm really enjoying watching you do it all. So Bodhisattva does everything in a spirit of play. In a way, it's no big deal. Remember when I was ordained, this is a long time ago now, in Tuscany. Just about to have the public ordination ceremony. These two Italian police motorcyclists turned up, demanding to see our passports. They were dressed in this incredible macho gear. You know, they had the kind of boots and the dark glasses and the jackets and the kind of cool way of kind of walking, you know. And it's a bit like suddenly entering, we're in this middle of a 3-month retreat, and it's suddenly like Monty Python had suddenly arrived, you know, Monty Python suddenly turned up. It's a bit like kind of Sangsara's last ditch attempt to prevent, you know, kind of ordinations going ahead. But they did go, we went ahead, and at the end, Sangharaksha's doing the ordinations, and he just got up to leave the shrine then. He might have thought, you know, he just ordained 15 people, he'd be pretty pleased with himself. And there were like 200 order members now, which at the time was a remarkable achievement. It's quite a significant event to suddenly have 200 order members. But he just got up and he just bowed to the shrine and left the room. Bowed to the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, bowed to the Three Jewels, left the room, and that was the end of the ceremony. So his heart rejoiced, but it wasn't about him, because he was dedicated. It wasn't about him at all. So what Shantideva does in his verses, or one thing he does in his verses, he makes a series of vows that express his personal response to the arising of the bodhicitta within him. But the bodhisattva's compassion isn't a to-do list. It's a flood of song. So in his verses on adopting the awakening mind, the bodhicitta, he says, I am medicine for the sick and weary. May I be their physician and their nurse until disease appears no more. May I strike down the anguish of thirst and hunger with rains of food and drink. May I be food and drink to them in famine and disaster. May I be an inexhaustible treasure for those in need. May I be their servant to give them all that they desire. Okay, so how does the bodhicitta arise? Well, everything that arises in the world does so in dependence on causes and conditions. So the arising of the bodhicitta depends upon certain mental and spiritual conditions which we create ourselves, within ourselves, through our practice. I'm quoting from Sangharakshita there. Perhaps I'll repeat that. The arising of the bodhicitta depends upon certain mental and spiritual conditions which we create within ourselves through our practice. So if we create these conditions, then the bodhicitta can arise. So all our practices move towards this end. A key method, a key way, is the sevenfold worship, as exemplified by Shantideva, when we're doing our sevenfold puja. Through doing the puja, we imitate what it's like to be a bodhisattva. And in imitating what it's like to be a bodhisattva, we thus begin to develop the qualities of a bodhisattva, begin to move towards being a bodhisattva. So we need to develop the aspiration and then take it out into the world. And we do this individually and collectively. There's no such thing as our own personal bodhicitta. That would be an absurd contradiction. There's only one bodhicitta. And the bodhicitta is as likely, if not more likely, to arise amongst a team of people, amongst a number of people working closely together for the Dharma. So at least as likely to arise in that kind of context as it is on our own. But either way, spiritual friendship is paramount. We're unlikely to get very far on our own. We need the help and encouragement of other people to grow and develop, to change. And it's through friendship with others that we can take what we've gained out into the world, what we can share with the world. The stronger the spiritual community is, the more we can share our values with the world. Our 21st century world needs those values more than ever. And we exemplify many things. For example, spiritual friendship. We can exemplify spiritual friendship. Friendship, well, at least friendship between men almost seems to be like real friendship, almost seems to be like a thing of the past. Not just bit kind of mates or colleagues that you work with, but kind of real deep abiding friendship is something that's very strong in the movement, very strong in the order in particular. The whole order is a network of friendships. So spiritual friendship is like something of immense value that we can take out into the world. An ability to work in a non-authoritarian way. And the last year, a mitra in Colchester was giving a talk I was at about what his experience was like coming along to the centre for the first time. And I was very interested in that because it's a long time ago since I first came along to the centre, and you can kind of forget what it's like. And he said he found it quite unnerving because nobody seemed to be in charge. So he found it like kind of difficult to kind of find his ground or find out, you know, how to kind of relate to what was going on, because there didn't seem to be anybody in charge. So it's like, of course, we work together in a non-authoritarian way. Got the practice of non-violence, taking responsibility for our actions. And we've got practices that actually work. There's a load of stuff on here. The internet's full of stuff, people with brilliant ideas about how to be liberated, but very little in terms of actual practices that work, that actually get you there. It's just like, be like me, you'll be fine. But it doesn't actually tell you, it actually help you actually get there. You actually need the practices. You need like a system of practice which is what we're offering, what Buddhism offers, what Chiratna offers, is a system of practice, step by step, that actually works if we follow it, and actually kind of takes us there, takes us where we want to go. So loftiness of Bodhi, the loftiness of Shantideva, might seem rather remote or distant or difficult, but if we allow the Buddha's teachings to guide us, they'll gradually become a reality. If we sincerely set up the conditions, then the fruit will manifest. We don't necessarily need to be all kind of mystical about it. We can think of it in neurological terms. As we develop new neurological pathways, new neural patterns, and as we repeatedly do that, we know from neuroscience, as we repeatedly do that, those pathways, those channels, will stay open. There comes a point where we won't fall back. Normally, or certainly when we start practicing, we practice for a bit and we get somewhere, and we, particularly if you go on retreat, we have a really great time, and then we come back and then it gets a bit difficult again, doesn't it? And we go away on retreat and it gets better again. And we gradually kind of go up, but we're kind of going up and a bit back and up and a bit back. And there comes a point where we just keep going up. So as we practice, our whole sense of what is possible changes. The old horizons, the old limits dissolve. A whole sense of life opens up. And even a small step on the way will make us happier and the world a better place. Shantideva. As a blind man may find a jewel in a pile of dung, by some miracle, so too, this awakening mind has somehow appeared in me. And there is born an elixir of life to destroy death, an inexhaustible treasure to conquer poverty, a supreme medicine to cure disease, a tree of rest for the weariness of staggering along the road of existence, an open bridge for travellers to cross beyond all evil destiny, a rising moon to cool the heat of passion, a great sun to dispel the darkness of ignorance, fresh butter churned from the milk of the true Dharma. It is a banquet of happiness laid out to refresh all who come, the caravan of beings wandering on the journey of existence, hungry to taste some happiness. Today I invite the world to Buddhahood with happiness along the way. Let all the gods, titans and all, in the presence of the protectors, rejoice. So in order to realise this in our lives, one thing we'll need to do is overcome our prejudices about other people, our fixed ideas about other people. We're not just helping the nice people, though that's a good place to begin. Usually if we find somebody difficult or someone's unskillful towards us in some kind of way, usually if we know something about their lives, we can understand why they are like they are. You know, if we know something about their childhood or whatever, something about the conditions of their life, well then we can usually understand, because we can usually see that if we'd had those conditions, if we'd have had the childhood they had, if we'd have had whatever's happened in their lives happen to us, well then we'd probably be the same. We'd probably think and act in the same way. So we're all trying to be happy. It's just some of us have a very deluded sense of deluded way of going about it. Nobody is inherently evil. All of us can change. And the extraordinary thing is that, well, if we can truly open our heart to another person, despite how they might be, despite how they are, despite what they might do to us, if we can do that, well, we actually feel a deep sense of joy and nourishment. What we actually lose is just a sense of isolation. We feel a deep sense of communion, a deep sense of solidarity with what it is to be human, what it is to be a human being. So our fear and aversion turn to compassion. One of my adolescent dreams was to grow my own veg and be self-sufficient. There was a lot of that sort of thing around, a certain amount of that sort of thing around at the time, I think. Well, you can grow your own veg, but that doesn't make you self-sufficient. We're all interdependent with other people. Our whole lives depend on other people. Even being born is a team effort, if you like. Even to come into existence in the world is like a team effort. The Shrewsbury Buddhist Centre is certainly a team effort. I was at a team meeting before we began this evening. So it's a sense, it's a lack of that sense of interdependence that's largely responsible for most of our global problems, our current global problems. Other people, other beings aren't separate from us. We can't just kind of wall people off, a bit like, as if we're kind of Donald Trump on the Mexican border. We can't just kind of wall off the rest of the world. We can't wall out other people because we're interdependent. So to tackle these issues, we may want to get together with other people. We may want to do so at a collective level, with like-minded people, might want to get together and try and do something about global issues on a global scale. But again, we need to do this on the basis of metta, or we'll simply end up overwhelmed, we'll simply end up being burnt out, or we'll simply end up being resentful or despairing if we don't do it from a basis of metta. And that's what happens, unfortunately, to so many very well-intentioned and good people. They just burn out. One of Sangharakshita's Tibetan teachers, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, he had this to say. He said, "Buddhism asserts that mind precedes all things. So mind is a fundamental level on which we must approach the cultivation of compassion. This is a slightly knotty point. Surely if actual help is needed, then we need to do something to relieve others' suffering. But people rush off to war zones for all kinds of wrong reasons, sometimes with motivations that have more to do with their own psychology than with any compassionate impulse. War zones aside, people try to help in everyday situations for reasons other than those they reveal or even acknowledge to themselves. Training the mind towards compassion includes clarifying our motivations, becoming aware of what needs doing, then cultivating a genuine longing to help." So we cultivate a genuine longing to help, a genuine heart of longing. But this means we need to turn inwards as well as outwards. We need to do inner work as well as outer work. If we don't turn inwards, we'll almost certainly be acting, to some extent at least, out of fear and prejudice. It's just the good old ego trying to manipulate things our way so we get the kind of world we feel comfortable in, that we want. And we think we're being altruistic. Whether we're doing inner work or going out, doing outer work, if you like, well, it may mean letting go of feeling good. Because if we insist on feeling good all the time, at least, we're not going to grow. It's not possible to feel good all the time and actually grow. As with everything in Buddhism, we need to find a middle way between extremes. We find a way forward that's workable for us as an individual. So my old RI teacher at school, when anybody volunteered to help him in any way, he never thanked them. He never said, "Oh, thank you." He'd just smile and say, "Great will be your reward in heaven." So, well, Buddhism doesn't posit an everlasting heaven for a fixed immortal soul, for those who act well. And it's not like we have to prove ourselves in any particular way. We don't have to prove ourselves worthy in some way. We are intrinsically worthy. Even the worst person we can think of is intrinsically pure beneath the evil action, whatever it is they're doing. People do evil things, but there are no evil people. But we do understand that if we act well, it will change us in some way. We'll become happier. If we act well, we'll become happier. In Buddhist terms, we receive the fruit of our karma. So we gain merit, as we say. Is that another one on your list? So we gain merit through our actions. Through positive actions, we gain merit. So dedication in Buddhism means dedication and merit. Dedication in Buddhism means dedication of merit. So most of us learn to meditate. I certainly did. Because I wanted to be happy. I wanted something for myself. I wanted to be happier. And that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. The centre's a bit like a spiritual A&E department. We kind of wander in and we like to be in need of some kind of certain amount of kind of tender care. Heal our bruises, restore our hearts. And it's fine just to take what we need and go. Everyone's welcome, no one's kind of chased, no one's kind of chased after. Assuming you don't kind of run off with a Buddha or something like that. It happened in Norwich one time. But nobody's kind of chased after you. People are free just to come and go. So it's a bit like a spiritual A&E, but it's also a bit like Doctor Who's TARDIS. Because from the outside, it looks like an old church hall. You think, oh, this is an old church hall. Nothing much here, maybe. Just an old church hall. Once you get inside, well, you've actually got the means to completely transcend time and space. You've got the practices that will actually help you to transcend time and space. So it's a bit like Doctor Who's TARDIS, except we're not going to another planet. We're only going to Shrewsbury. We're only going here and seeing Shrewsbury seeing Shrewsbury as it really is. We're seeing Shrewsbury in all its beauty and wonder. We're seeing the world in all its beauty and wonder, free of our subjective hang-ups, free of all our stuff. So it's as if we seeing Shrewsbury for the first time. We're not seeing it through a fog. We're just seeing it directly with our heart. Seeing it as it is. Free of the pain that comes from putting ourselves at the centre of the universe. We're seeing Shrewsbury with new eyes, entering a whole new world. So happiness will be limited if we only concern ourselves with our own development. If we aspire towards being a bodhisattva, if we wish to move towards being a bodhisattva, then we give away our merits. We give the merits away. That actually gives us more merit, so we give that away too. We don't simply enjoy the fruits of our efforts. We help others as we've been helped. We help others to experience what we've experienced. And we help others less fortunate than ourselves in whatever way we can. And we help the world in which we live in whatever way we can. So this is our everyday practice. We work with our mind, we work with our heart, we give away the fruit of our practice. It's not about gaining enlightenment for ourselves. That would be a contradiction in terms. And it's not about rushing off like the proverbial headless chicken trying to save the world. We practice the middle way, starting from wherever we happen to be at, realistically, genuinely, where we actually happen to be at. In line, we practice in line with our own interests and our own capabilities, our own capacities. And it doesn't require any particular belief. We can just do it and see what happens. We can just try it and see what happens. And if it works for us, well then we can begin to trust the process and take it deeper. We can have increasing confidence as we go on. So although we're giving everything away, that requires a certain strength. It's not a strength and confidence in our ability to get our own way, but a confidence in our intrinsic worth, and that by engaging with that intrinsic worth, we can be of benefit to others. So we need to develop certain qualities, particular qualities such as generosity, fearlessness, empathy, tenderness. We need to be able to let down our defences, and that requires courage. The idea that the world outside us is false, it's just an idea. It's just a concept that we've stuck on top of our experience and mistaken it for the truth. The closed self-protective heart needs to open and reach out. The self-interested mind needs to educate itself. And all this is rooted in metta. And in the process, we discover that the universe is unconditional love. That our self-view simply got in the way. So in addressing the monks, Shantideva demonstrates the mind resolving itself on the bodhicitta, on the awakening mind. He says, as the well-gone ones took up the awakening mind and resolved upon the practice of bodhisattvas in ages past, so shall I generate this awakening mind for the welfare of the world, and I shall follow their practice. And when the wise one who has taken up the awakening mind with a serene confidence in this way, let him rejoice that it may grow, that it may thrive, and say, today my birth is fruitful, my human life is justified, today I am born into the family of the Buddha, now I am the Buddha's son. So in everyday terms, we're the son or daughter of our parents. When the bodhicitta arises, well, we're the son or daughter of the Buddhas, son or daughter of a Buddha. Because it's the Buddhas who give birth to wisdom and compassion. It's the Buddhas that give birth to our wisdom and compassion. And it's on the basis of wisdom and compassion, rather than our past conditioning, that we now relate to the world. Getting towards the end, not got far to go. So there is another way of looking at this. We could ask, who are we anyway? Who is this apparently separate person? Who is this me? If I had my DNA tested, I might discover, I don't know, part Anglo-Saxon, part Viking, maybe there's some Celtic strain in there somewhere, maybe some Norman, maybe some German, mostly chimpanzee. We have an identity, but on closer examination, it doesn't stand up. The more we look at our identity, the more it unravels like a layer of an onion. So who am I anyway? I could give you my life story, but I wouldn't tell you who I am. It would just be just a story. And I might give a different story tomorrow. It's a story of my identity. It's not actually who I am. So according to the Dharma, we have no separate selfhood. It's like when we dream, we think we're a real autonomous person when we dream. And then we wake up and we find it's an illusion. But it's an illusion that we continue to create when we're awake, but we're just unaware that we're doing it. So the whole story of me is like an illusion. It's like a dream. And when we wake up to nirvana, the illusion of a separate selfhood disappears. So it's important not to take that in the wrong kind of way. It's not like we get annihilated into nothingness. We still have a sense of beingness, if you like, for want of a word. But it can't be defined in terms of a self or an identity. It's not something that can be conceptualized. It's not something that can be put into words. So a bodhisattva is someone who doesn't help beings on the basis that there's one person helping another. Nor is it on the basis of a man helping a woman or a woman helping a man. We relate beyond gender differences. It's not that we don't, not that we've all become kind of neuter, or we kind of don't relate to people as men or women. We don't relate on that basis. We don't relate on gender differences. Nor is it an English person, say, helping a Syrian refugee. We relate beyond national differences. We relate beyond national identity. It's not me saving all beings. It's not something we do as a separate person. We simply participate in something that's beyond the duality. And that's what we call the bodhicitta. We participate in something that's beyond the sense of me and you, of self and other. And that's the bodhicitta. So something else takes over. Something greater than our narrow self-identity. And what takes over is what in Buddhism we mean by compassion. So this is the noblest ideal according to Buddhism. This is the cessation of suffering according to the Buddha. And this is the greatest way, this is the way to the greatest happiness for ourselves and for others. So we begin with self-metta and we end up becoming unconditional love. We don't have to participate in the banquets, to use Shantideva's image. We don't have to gain enlightenment. It's not compulsory. We don't have to gain enlightenment if we don't want to. It's all up to us. But each small step on the way means a saner world. And each small step on the way means less suffering. Each small step on the way is a cause to rejoice. So the ego, the narrow sense of ourselves, the little me, well, it's a strategy for survival. It's part of the evolutionary process. It's finding its own way. It has its place. It's part of the evolutionary process. But it can't deliver any kind of lasting happiness. It keeps us in a state of fear and anxiety. We're always trying to get what we want and not get what we don't want. True peace and happiness, true fulfillment and completeness, actually comes from going beyond ourselves. We open more and more deeply to our actual experience of what is. Every moment offers a fresh universe to explore. So we connect with our own suffering, the suffering of others, and we heal and we let go. And we find that our own deepest needs for peace and freedom meet the deepest needs for peace and freedom in the world. And the key is self-surrender. It's what we hold on to that causes us so much pain and limits our scope in the world. So we do our spiritual practice and we give away the merit. We have the ideal Buddhist, the Bodhisattva, and we have where we are now, with all our human failings and difficulties. And we bridge the gap between them with dedication. And by my merit, may we ever hear the sound of the Dharma, in the song of the birds, in the whispering of the trees, in the dancing sunbeams. And every creature be a Buddha in the world, to taste neither sorrow nor hardship. And as long as the earth and sky shall last, may I remain here to heal the sorrows of the world. I take upon myself the sorrows of the world, and may the world be happy.